Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, January 25th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Frisk. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Landry Harlan from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now we'll look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Gwen, for some time now, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station has been listed as among the poorest performing nuclear plants in the country. Column 4, they call this, for many safety concerns. Now it may be moving out of that category, perhaps. Tell us about this.
It's interesting, the perspective you put on that, because for several years we've been reading that it'll be closing in May of 2019. And now it's coming up on May of 2019. One of the things that the owners, Entergy, have been trying to do is to improve their safety and performance record from that column 4 up to a column 1. And where we're starting from is that there were, in a 2017 report, there were 156 deficiencies identified. The inspector said that Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station at that time just being run, but not taking care of other maintenance and looking ahead and that kind of thing. So now where we're at in the latest report is that the last 40 of those 156 deficiencies have been dealt with, and it may have taken the plant to a point where it can finish strong for the shutdown.
So the shutdown is still scheduled for end of May this year. And they're looking to move out of this column, in which they've basically had a lot more oversight in than they would have had otherwise for the last couple of years.
That's true. Although I found it interesting in this story, Christine Legere covers Pilgrim for us all the time. And this is, I thought, an interesting distinction. Even if they move into the best category and finish strong, they will still have the same amount of oversight on the closure part.
On the decommissioning.
Right.
It won't
yes.
change how the decommissioning
exactly.
is handled.
It'll just change for the next few months, you know, how often they're required to be inspected.
So while they've been in column 4, they've been subjected to hundreds of hours of additional scrutiny by federal inspectors. They're looking to move into column 1 so that they no longer have all this special oversight. How's the company sounding about trying to make this transition? The company that owns the Pilgrim plant is Entergy.
Yes, right. I went by that a little bit quickly in the first mention. It's interesting because part of doing this has been bringing the staff and managers into, you know, onto the same page. The items that were associated with nuclear safety and the culture of that safety, the inspector spoke with 131 workers and managers and found that now there appears to be good communication channels and positive environment for raising safety concerns, which is what they found totally lacking when they first did the report in 2017.
And Pilgrim Nuclear, when they think about all the nuclear plants across the country, this was one of only 98 of them.
Sorry.
This was only one of 9 plants that had ever been placed in column 4. Just to give an indication
of
how.
It was of great concern
how
to
concerned it was.
People, you know,
the concern
in
was.
Plymouth, where the plant is located. We forget to say that every now and then because we assume people know, but also here on the Cape. Because any kind of a problem would affect the entire region.
So whether or not it moves out of column 4 is going to be decided by the NRC, and there's a timeline on that. They're expecting to make an announcement in March on whether that moves out of column 4 to column 1. The offshore wind company Vineyard Wind addressed some concerns this week, some from fishermen and others about potential impacts on endangered right whales. Let's see. We heard about this. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I'm sorry.
Tell us what we know about this. The company is trying to address concerns of Rhode Island fishermen and the conservationists who are concerned about what happens when they start building these turbines, what happens to species such as the endangered right whale.
once again, I'm going to start by reminding people that Vineyard Wind is building an 84-turbine wind farm, and it's expected to deliver enough electric power to take care of about 400,000 homes in Massachusetts. And that power would come in via an underwater high-voltage cable that would land on a Barnstable beach from the wind farm, which would be just south of Martha's Vineyard. So that's the setting. And the latest situation is that the Vineyard Wind officials did not wait for federal officials to return to their desks during the shutdown. They reached out with an agreement to environmental groups specifically to protect the North Atlantic right whales, and has offered and they've also offered Rhode Island fishermen a $6.3 million deal to compensate them for any economic damages that incur from the wind farm and on their potential livelihood. The right whale, as we've reported before, is severely endangered. Critically endangered is the word that they use. And so it becomes a great priority for when anything is done in the ocean, but specifically.
Only about 400 of these North American right whales, they are believed to still be in existence. We just heard this week about a third calf that was born. But this specifically is about Vineyard Wind trying to build in an area where people are concerned that it could impact the right whale. What kinds of things has Vineyard Wind agreed to do here to mitigate that impact?
Well, under the agreement, which approval is still pending from the conservation groups, but under the agreement, Vineyard Wind would adopt seasonal restrictions for pile driving because, based on experience, scientists know that the right whales are likely to be in our area during the spring. Make sure I have this right. And so this would cut the possibility of them being injured to close to zero, according to the offer that was on the table this week.
The conservation groups seem very pleased by this. A couple of spokespeople for the conservation groups coming out and saying that Vineyard Wind is going beyond what the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management would have required them to do to protect the right whales here.
Yes, Regina Asmutis Sylvia, who's with the North America Office of Whale and Dolphin Conservation in Plymouth, said that this is, quote, "It's a huge improvement over what, as you said, the Bureau was going to require of them." So they've gone above and beyond what the regulation expectation would have been.
In a lot of ways, it looks like Vineyard Wind is sort of smoothing the path here to try to make sure that they can move ahead with their project as swiftly as possible. I know they're pushing against the calendar a little bit. They have to break ground, so to speak, before the end of the year to take advantage of some tax credits towards this project. But the Rhode Island fishermen component really was about the fishermen complaining that the turbines would obstruct their fishing rights. And now Vineyard Wind has come up with a number. It's a fairly big number that they're offering to Rhode Island fishermen to try to offset this, to compensate them for that.
Yes. So that's $6.3 million. That's part of the deal that they've offered.
And the fishermen have not yet decided to they have not taken a vote on whether that is going to be an acceptable offer. This is still out there on the table.
Yes. Lanny Dellinger, who is chairman of Fisheries Advisory Board of the Rhode Island Coastal Resource Management Council, said that they've not voted. They're in the process of reviewing the proposal.
We're going to speak now with Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Landry.
Good morning, Steve.
Landry, the director at the Island Airport, has announced that she'll be leaving the job this spring. Tell us what's happening here.
It's true. She announced her resignation earlier this week, effective in May. So it's a bit of a surprise. She's just been on the job for 3 years.
Ann Reichert?
Ann Richard, yes.
Ann Richard.
And this is happening at kind of a turbulent, forgive the pun, time at the airport. There's plans going on to expand the airport that have caused some community backlash, more than doubling the size of the terminal, adding hangars, parking spaces, things like that. There's a current investigation into water contamination in some private wells near the airport. And the big thing is last week there was a report released that said that the airport financials had some major deficiencies. So a lot of challenges going on at the airport, and the airport will no longer have Ms. Richard to guide them through it. She said she, in a press release, that she wanted to go to the West Coast, spend more time with her elderly mother and family. I spoke with the airport commission chair, Bob Rosenbaum, this week. They kind of oversee the airport management. And he praised Ms. Richard for her contributions over 3 years, saying she did a lot to secure federal state grant money for projects at the airport, and really getting the airport out of an even more difficult time before she got here. There was FAA sanctions, lawsuits, a lot of trouble. And now as they're looking forward, Bob said that he'd like to have a new person in by April, pretty quick turnaround. So there's some overlap before, again, Ms. Richard leaves in May. But there's a lot of challenges ahead, and he says the new director is going to have to take those head on pretty quickly. So we are keeping a close eye on who they choose next.
Landry Harlan from the Vineyard Gazette. Landry, thanks for checking in with us on that.
No problem, Steve.
Gwen Friss is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, the town of Barnstable is expecting a higher demand for water in the future, which means it needs to locate sites for new municipal wells. Tell us about this.
Well, town officials are saying that this is something they're working on now because of what they anticipate is coming. It's not, you know, that they need them today. But there's area, there's the area in question, there's room for development, both commercial and residential, and there are concerns that that will require more water, you know, and new town wells. So they, the place that they're looking at is near where the town, near where town wells are now, but it's on state land. So this is where they will have to figure out how to ask the state if they can use it, and that's what they're working on now. It's likely that we would see a some kind of a land trade if the state allows this its conservation land to be used for an additional 5 wells, that they would be looking to have other land placed into conservation status.
And the area that they're looking at now is a conservation property that's north of the Barnstable Municipal Airport. It's a 250-acre property there. Tell us a little bit about they're being proactive here, as you say. This is not a need that's come up already, but they're looking down the road and they're planning that there may be a need for an expanded water supply.
And I'm going to say also that for those of us who have trouble with directions, that this is sort of near Independence Park. That mm-hmm. That's what we're looking at. For me, that puts a picture in my head much more quickly. And now I forgot your question, Steve. You're looking for what?
They're just building for they're looking to expand for the future, is what I was saying.
Yes.
And that this has a timeline that they're moving forward now to try to identify this, so they can figure out whether they have to do a land swap or not. I guess there's some question whether they're going to have to swap with the state to even get the land for these wells.
And the town officials are saying, first of all, we're grateful the state is talking to us about this. And there are a couple of studies going on which would allow both sides, and especially the state, to take a look at what the impact of this might be. There are concerns that if they put in 5 additional wells in that area, that it could I shouldn't say concerns, but there are questions. There's a, you know, wait and see, want to explore first attitude about whether it would affect any of the existing ecosystems out there, mm-hmm. and you know, whether drawing that water out, that additional water, would affect the rest of the conservation land that's out there.
This is the News Roundup. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. And joining us now on the phone from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, a couple of environmental issues are on the town meeting warrant in Chatham. They have to do with banning some single-use items. What's going on here?
Sure. Well, we all have heard a lot lately about pollution in the environment, especially the marine environment, plastics specifically. Down here at the Orpheum Theater, there was recently an exhibit of art made out of plastic debris that was found along the shore. Now, sort of building on that, at May's annual town meeting, Chatham voters will face two citizen petition articles that deal with plastic pollution. The first would ban single-use styrofoam containers, the ones that you'd get at a restaurant for takeout items, for instance, or cups and bowls, and even packing peanuts. Now, styrofoam is actually a trademark of a type of expanded polystyrene foam, plastic foam. One of the petitioners in this case, William Bystrom, pointed out that the problem with this material is that it's not recyclable. It doesn't break down in the environment, and it often finds its way onto the side of the road or into the marine waters where it becomes unsightly pollution. Now, this petition that they're working on is targeted at local food service establishments that use these styrofoam containers, he said, and would encourage them to switch to cardboard or paper material. There are quite a few major cities, including New York, which just adopted a ban similar to this this past January. And there are two local communities, Falmouth and Nantucket, who have similar bans in place. Now, the other petition, the second town meeting measure that voters will deal with, seeks to prohibit town government from buying and using beverages in plastic containers. It's basically aimed at eliminating the town from using plastic water bottles. Now, this particular effort is part of a Cape-wide initiative sponsored by the Brewster-based nonprofit Sustainable Practices, which is working to get similar measures on town meeting warrants across the region this spring. Plastic water bottles can be recycled, but they often aren't and end up alongside the road again or mixed in with solid waste, which adds to the cost of disposing of that material that that towns have to pay. Sustainable Practices says they ultimately would like to seek bans on the sale of all plastic water bottles on the Cape, and they will be seeking community preservation grants in town by town to establish public water stations where people can refill or they can fill up refillable bottles, mm-hmm. metal bottles or glass bottles or something like that. And both of these petitions really have just been announced. They have yet to get much feedback from town officials or the community. We'll be curious to hear what some of the restaurants and food service establishments have to say about them. And I expect they'll be presented to the Board of Selectmen within the next few weeks. The plastic bottle petition has gained enough signatures to get on the warrant. The other petition, the styrofoam petition, the language is being crafted right now, and the petitioners say they've got enough signatures to get it on the warrant. They haven't submitted those yet, but they expect to do so anytime now.
And Tim, that styrofoam ban, that's just for food service items, right? It's not for things like marine buoys or things like that.
Exactly. It wouldn't apply to uses of styrofoam for marine items, or, it's also used in the building trade for mm-hmm. insulation and things like that. Basically, we're talking about single-use food service items or, takeout, sometimes. And also, it would cover packing peanuts as well.
Mm. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
Gwen Friss is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, mental health services will be expanding on the Lower Cape. Tell us what's happening here.
Well, this is very good news for the Lower Cape because the problem has been that, just based on the geography of our home, the Hyannis-based organization that is dealing with people who need help with mental health issues, one of them, it's been delayed in getting to, calls from, for example, the Chatham Police Chief, and this has been a problem. So what's happening now is that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts has granted a $200,000 grant to the to the Bay Cove Human Services. Now, that's the group that took over the mobile crisis response duties of the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health back in May of 2017. What that money will allow, the organization's leaders say, is that they'll be able to hire three additional people, including one who will be based in an office on the Lower Cape, possibly in Orleans. That's what they're looking at right now. This is moving quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking to do this possibly within a couple of months, and then to have a person in place to hire those people, and then to open the office shortly after that.
And this is, as you say, to cut down on response times. This company, Bay Cove, was part of an effort by the state to privatize some of these services. It's
right.
A nonprofit that offers this these services. Tell us about the police have been concerned about some of these response times, right, and why it's so important to have mental health services to go along with some of these calls.
Absolutely. The chief had some concerns, and he was saying that the Bay Cove does a good job, but it takes a while for them to get there for some of the calls. And the Jacqueline Lane, the executive director of NAMI Cape Cod, is saying the same thing, that it just is a concern when there's an immediate need, an urgent need, that it takes a while to get there, just get someone out of the Hyannis office and able to get down there, especially in off hours, like response, emergency response. So, I mean, Bay Cove has 38 people on the Cape now and operates a 7-bed crisis stabilization unit in Hyannis. And, they're committed to serving the entire Cape, but it's just that this will allow them to respond more quickly.
There is a story in today's paper about the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Council stripping its chairman, Cedric Cromwell, of financial control in tribe business. And moving even further, approving a vote of no confidence in Cromwell.
And these votes were dramatic. The stripping of the financial powers was a 7-0 vote, and the no confidence vote was 9-0. A spokesman for the tribe said that actually Aaron Toby Jr. said, and he is not. I correct myself. He is not a spokesman for the tribe. Mm-hmm. He is Cromwell's former right-hand man, and he's now running for a tribal council seat himself in the upcoming election. But he said that he recommended the council take up this motion of no confidence last week after learning from a Cape Cod Times article that the chairman and his wife, council member Cheryl Fry Cromwell, owe the IRS roughly $37,000 in unpaid taxes. Now, that's a personal bill. That's not having to do with the council. But it did raise the question about finances and whether they wanted Mr. Cromwell to be in that position.
And what's interesting here, perhaps, is that having taken this vote of no confidence and stripping him of the financial powers, he's still the tribal chairman.
He is. And we're hearing from sources who were at the meeting, because the tribal council members were not talking about it. And Mr. Cromwell said that he would not discuss tribal finances with non-tribal members. So we're hearing this, but there is talk that Vice Chairwoman Jessie Littledoe Baird, who is the second in command on the council, mm-hmm. Might be the one to step up and handle financial matters.
We're going to speak right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning.
Ed, last week brought the news that the poet Mary Oliver had died. For more than 50 years, she made Provincetown her home. You have a great article that gets behind some of the mythology of Mary Oliver and really brings forward her human side. Tell us about this.
Yes. Mary Oliver, of course, was a widely beloved and greatly honored poet, as Monique Laborde's report in the Last Hour of Mourning edition nicely laid out. But she was a complicated person, as Anne Wood writes in this week's Banner. She came to Provincetown in 1964 with Molly Malone Cook, who was her life partner and literary agent, and they opened a bookstore here, the East End Bookshop. Cook had been Norman Mailer's assistant, and Oliver and Cook had met at Edna St. Vincent Millay's home in Austerlitz, New York. Their bookshop was a well-known spot. John Waters, the filmmaker, worked there for a while, and he describes how idiosyncratic they were, so that he says, for example, Molly yelled at people if they asked for Valley of the Dolls. And if anyone said anything negative about Norman Mailer's books, Molly and Mary would say, "Get out, get out." Waters said it was really fun to work there because the customer was always wrong. of course, Oliver was an absolutely stunning poet of nature. She won the Pulitzer Prize in 1984 and the National Book Award in 1992. Her poems are rightly beloved. She talked about, she said, I could not be a poet without the natural world. Someone else could, but not me. For me, the door to the woods is the door to the temple. But at the same time, she's known for sometimes freezing out people that she felt had slighted her. You know, Steve, it's been noted, I think, that sometimes great artists are difficult people in real life. I think Robert Frost is known for that as well. John Waters puts it, I think, beautifully when he says, "I adored Mary, but I always delighted in how kind of different she was than people imagined. She was a drama queen. She was always in a feud." He says, "She didn't suffer fools, I'll tell you that much. She didn't even suffer people who weren't fools. She didn't suffer smart people." But that really doesn't take anything at all, I think, away from the beauty and power of her poetry. And as Monique noted on the last hour, there will be an open mic celebration of her work at 2 p.m. on this Sunday, the 27th, in the Marc Jacobs Reading Room of the Provincetown Public Library. Members of the public are invited to come and share their appreciation of Mary Oliver's poetry by reading or listening to others read their favorite works. Open mic sign-up starts at 1:30.
Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Gwen, some environmental groups and local fishermen are warning that fundamental changes are needed in the way the science is used to regulate the fisheries.
That's true, and I'm just getting back on board with our story here because I so enjoyed that report on Mary Oliver. I was listening instead of preparing my own homework here. What is happening right now is that in a December 20th letter, the Environmental Defense Fund and the Conservation Law Foundation said that there's a real problem with how we count fish stocks in this area, and that's the linchpin, because those are the numbers that are used to set fishing limits and to decide what's not going to be fished for a season and that kind of thing. So their letter said that it went to regional and national fishing officials and who are in charge of rebuilding the stocks of cod, haddock, flounder, and other bread and butter New England species. The letter covers a little bit about how the environmental groups see the process as a flawed one, a fundamentally flawed one. And that includes federal fishery observers who travel with commercial fishing boats and also go out for counts on some of the private boats. And how they are counting that once they're out there. So that's the crux of what the concerns are with these two environmental groups.
One of the things they're pointing out is that the fishery scientists, they say, don't have even accurate models, that if they work backwards, their predictions aren't, even after they've taken stock assessments, their predictions don't match the models. And so there's something fundamentally flawed about the way that they're collecting data or about the data they're collecting. And they're looking, they're saying that they may have to, they may instigate a lawsuit, initiate a lawsuit if this cannot be addressed. And one of the things I think they really want to see is more observers or a different approach to the observer program. They say that there's not enough observers yet on these boats.
That's true. And Doug Fraser, who covers fisheries, has covered that in detail in a story this week that looks at the possibility of the lawsuits, but also looks at what the conservation groups see as those flaws.
There is, I think the government mandates that there have to be 15% of fishing trips have to have observers. And so far, these groups are pointing out just 8% of these boats have had observers on them, the fishing trips. And they're also pushing to have electronic observation methods put onto boats so that they can cut down on the man hours that it requires to observe these fishing trips. We're going to go to the break now. This is the News Roundup. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. When we come back, we'll be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point, and we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. On the phone with us right now is George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, we talked earlier in the program about the director at the Island Airport leaving the position. One of the big issues ongoing there at the airport is the contamination of private wells by chemicals from firefighting foams. The airport has now identified a plan for dealing with this. You've got an article covering this.
That's right. This week they, late last week, they filed their plans with the Mass Department of Environmental Protection on exactly what they found in their investigation, which was, 13 private wells were above the state guideline for PFAS, and PFAS is a type of contamination that comes from firefighting foam that's used at the airport. What their action plan is in terms of dealing with that. What they're going to do is 26 of these private wells they're going to install what they call a point of entry system. With carbon filters that will filter out this particular contaminant. They've already put it into one of the private homes, and it's working as advertised. And so they'll be doing this starting in February, and it'll they'll continue working on it into the spring to get all these homes back using their private wells. For now, they're on bottled water. One of the interesting things about this is it's going to cost about $4,000 for each of these. So in total, it'll be over $100,000. The airport undertook this entire investigation on their own before they were ordered to do it. The consultant that works with them, Tetra Tech, had pitched to them to get ahead of this, and that's what they did. This is not the end of the investigation. However, Tetra Tech Representative Ron Myrick told us this week that they'll be continuing to sample wells, particularly in the vicinity of where they found positive results. Some of those homes haven't been tested yet because they're seasonal homes and they just haven't had access to water system yet. So this is still going to be an ongoing story, I would say, into the spring and summer.
George, also there was a ceremony at the West Tisbury Fire Station this week to honor some first responders, and this follows up on a story that we've talked about previously.
That's right. The first baby of the new year on the island, as people likely recall, was born in the back of an ambulance. Solstice came into the world a little more quickly than her parents had hoped. They called 911, and the baby was born in the ambulance. And so
it's the first time on the island that a baby was born in the ambulance.
Yeah, we didn't know that at the time definitively. We speculated that at the time, but now we know definitively that this is the first time that this has happened. It is a pretty rare occurrence, but ambulance crews are trained in this, and when it happens, they're ready, and certainly the Tri-Town ambulance crew, the Dukes County Sheriff's Department, folks who answered the phone, and the West Tisbury Police Department, they were all ready and prepared for this, and the Hennigans were at the fire station to thank them all. We can report that mom, baby, dad, and all the people who worked on this are doing quite fine.
And to honor the crew here, the first responders, they gave them these special pins. They're blue stork pins.
That's right. That's a tradition when something like this happens, and everybody readily accepted their blue stork pins with appropriate smiles. So it's a happy ending to this story, and we'll have to see how Solstice progresses through the years here. We'll eagerly await that.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Gwen Friss is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, local educators are speaking out against what they say is a flawed state formula for funding education. They say local schools need more support.
That's right. And one of the things that they say is flawed about it is that it hasn't been changed since 1993, as the world has changed, but the funding mechanism that matches state and local money for schools has not changed. I'm looking at this and thinking, let me see if I can put this simply. In 1993, the legislature said that there was a minimum amount that should be spent on each student.
Mm-hmm.
And that based on property taxes, the local community would contribute a certain amount, and then the state would make up the difference for that. So that's kind of the short version of that, which I actually remember covering way back then. But the problem, teachers are saying, for example, we spoke with Lori Gilbert, a Bourne teacher and president of the Bourne Educators Association. The problem is that that doesn't take into account the fact that, one, towns have been cutting their taxes. And, so that's cutting down the base. And also the challenges of educating young people today are much greater. You have a lot of emerging English speakers, kids who are coming from poverty homes where they're below the poverty line. And that this has placed a lot of pressure on being able to educate the kids. And since they're not getting adequate increases in the state funding, that means that what's getting squeezed out are things like school libraries, music, art, and, in the public colleges, which is a little bit separate, but you also see an increase in tuition, and it's hurting the ability of students to use those colleges as a stepping stone, you know. So this is something that we heard from educators not only in Bourne, but in Barnstable and several other towns. If this proposal were passed, if this new legislature updated the funding formula, according to the site's interactive map, the Barnstable School District would receive $4.7 million in additional money, and the Dennis Yarmouth Regional District would get $2.6 million in Chapter 70 aid in the fiscal year 2023, because this would be something where it would be phased in over 5 years.
And they're looking at, overall for the state, an increase of about $1 billion over 5 years. Governor Baker just, I think yesterday, came out with a proposal that looking for about $1 billion over 7 years to go to education. Opponents saying that's not enough and it's going to take too long. So Beacon Hill will be going at this, and it's looking likely to be one of the big legislative issues of 2019. Let me ask you, Gwen, about the man, a story we heard this week, the man arrested in the killing of Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon last year has been charged now in a jail attack.
Thomas Latanowicz, who's 30 now, was arraigned January 16th via a video conference link and between the Barnstable County Correctional Facility and the Falmouth District Court. He was charged, he faced charges for an attack in which another inmate was slashed in the face and ear with a modified razor. This was interesting because the report says that the whole thing was captured on camera. According to that account that was filed in the court papers, Latanowicz was talking with this other inmate. The inmate turned away, and at that point, Latanowicz pulled out this razor and attacked him with it. A fight ensued, and at some point, as jail officials were coming, the other inmate picked up the razor and got it out of the way. Now, the jail officials have been unable to get any information from the other inmate. And interestingly, Thomas Latanowicz is being held on $1 million bail, according to Judge Welch from the Falmouth District Court. But he was already in the facility with the charges he faces in Sergeant Gannon's death. He was already being held without bail. So I'm not quite sure exactly why that additional bail is there, but certainly it and the listeners may recall that happened back in April when Sergeant Gannon was shot while he was searching for Latanowicz and who also shot his police dog.
The Steamship Authority is looking to fill some high-level open positions as well as considering some new ones. This comes in the wake of a critical independent review.
That review said that the Steamship Authority needed to have these positions filled and to create a new position so that they could do a better job at foreseeing eventual problems and at training people in terms of safety. So that's what they're looking to do right now. In 2018, there were several incidents in which they had three ships that blacked out. People were stuck, on the ferry. And they also had a grounding that year. There were several things going on. So they are looking to fill a treasurer, port captain, and human resources director, and seeking candidates for those jobs, according to Robert Davis, the boat line's general manager, and also to hire they're looking for candidates for the position, this would be newly created, of Director of Marine Operations. This is someone who would oversee all vessel employees. So you have standardization on how things are done and what to do if there is a problem.
Let me ask you about a story we had this week that we've been talking about on the roundup actually over the past month or two about the efforts of the town of Barnstable to modify water protection rules. But now it looks like any decision on that is going to be put off until the summer. The town of Barnstable there suggesting that they've been operating under these interim rules for about 10 years. They're going to kick the can down or give themselves some more time to figure out a comprehensive plan here.
And that extends the period of public comment too. So people, if people have concerns about this area, this would be the time to catch up, with past stories because it has been covered by you guys and by us, and to go ahead and get in your public comments before the board takes up this issue.
And the issue will be at a public hearing on June 25th is when they're going to next take this up. And it has been contentious so far. Even on past Tuesday, nearly 100 people attended a late afternoon meeting at Town Hall on this. This is about modifications of the water regulations that they have enacted in Barnstable, their interim regulations enacted 10 years ago, supposedly while a comprehensive plan was being put together. The Conservation Law Firm, Conservation Law Foundation, and a number of environmental groups pushing the town of Barnstable to come up with a comprehensive water plan here. Gwen, the town of Truro is moving ahead with a project to create a significant amount of new housing, but there are still a number of outstanding questions here.
Yes, it's a 41-unit housing project, those questions, those lingering questions, have to do with the number and design of units to accommodate people with disabilities. Susan Howe, chairwoman of the town's Commission on Disabilities, said at the select board's meeting that that she was urging the board to get input from someone on her commission, you know, about the accessibility issues and that sort of thing.
It's quite a big proposal. They're looking at 22 one-bedroom, 15 two-bedroom, and 4 3-bedroom units. And this is right along a piece of land that Truro has gotten from the state in order to develop into more affordable housing for the town there. The questions of accessibility are ones that they're trying to figure out how to do. They want people to be able to age in place in some of these units, and but the terrain suggests that there's going to be a lot of stairs, and the commission here is looking to see select board looking to see possibilities for elevators to be put in this building.
Right. As you've sort of summed up the many of the outstanding issues for the Cloverleaf Housing Project, as it's being called, and the select board voted unanimously to award the development of the project to Community Housing Resource, and it would be the largest undertaken by the company, which has been building housing, artist studios, and commercial space for about 25 years on the Lower Cape in the towns of Provincetown, Truro, and Wellfleet.
Gwen, in the last 2 minutes of the program here, I want to ask you about a program that you do each week. It's a Facebook Live program, and it's called Life with Gwen. For anyone who hasn't seen it yet, first, just tell us about this.
Well, this is I'm the lifestyle editor at the Cape Cod Times, so this is a half-hour Facebook Live talk show where we bring folks in from the community that we think you would all like to meet. And I forgot it was on radio. I'm like talking to a camera that's not there, and it gives people a chance to ask questions because they can type their questions in for our guests. And this week we actually had a line outside the studio door of my colleagues because we had a very special guest. His name is Nickerson, and he is a Eastern screech owl. And
you had a screech owl as a guest.
We had an Eastern screech owl. They don't pay me enough, but it ended up being fine because these guys only grow to about 12 inches and 2 pounds. And oh, was he cute? Looked like a kitten, you know? And he brought his person with him, Stephanie Ellis, who is the executive director of Wildcare Inc. on Cape Cod. And I was amazed at the number of cases. They had 1,800 animals, wild animals brought in, small wild animals brought in for care and rehabilitation last year.
And was Nickerson one of these that had been rehabilitated?
No, actually he can't be, sadly, because what happened was when he was still an owlet, I didn't even know that was a word, when he was still an owlet, the tree that his family's nest was in was felled, and because they didn't know that there was an owl nest, and he was injured. He lost an eye, and this was of interest to me. Older owls who lose an eye are able to be rehabilitated because they already have a memory of binocular vision. But because this poor little guy wasn't able to learn how to fly and hunt before he was injured, he cannot be released. He will be working as an animal ambassador. And you can see him, if you would like to, on Life. You go to CapeCodTimes.com/LifeWithGwen, and we have all of our shows posted there. You can listen to the podcast, although I would think you want to see the owl, and by going to that address and adding the word podcast.
What day of the week do you do Life with Gwen?
Wednesday at high noon.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Gwen Frist from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us, Steve.
And thanks to all our other contributors. We heard from Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.